While it was going on, I had a question posed to me via an instant message.
Oh, yeah?
And the question, or maybe it was more of a comment, really, about the Samsung commercials that are playing right now.
Oh, yeah?
Which is, vaguely, they have like this line of people.
Yeah.
And they never explicitly say it's for an iPhone, do they? It's pretty obvious that...
No, it's obvious.
Yeah, so it's a line of people for an iPhone.
I just want a quick insert here that... how long you and I tried to avoid talking about this app.
Yeah, we didn't really want to bring this up because this was something we had talked about a long time ago, but we didn't really... Tom and I both like Apple quite a bit. I might be a bit more fanatical about it.
Yeah.
So obviously you can take some of this with a grain of salt, but Samsung has run these ads for 2 years now. So it's when they release a new iPhone, when Apple is about to release a new iPhone, Samsung runs an ad with people standing in line for the iPhone, and the people seem really dumb. And they seem, they're talking about the new phone and how excited they are. And they're always like, well, this one's white instead. And they just say stupid things that, like, are very cliche. And then someone walks by the line and is using a Samsung phone, and everyone in line is really impressed by it. And then Samsung's all like, blah, 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 blah. And I think from an operational standpoint, the commercials convey a few messages, one of which is what Samsung wants, which is, like, these products are not all that different. And we don't make a big deal out of ours because we know they're good, which is a little weird.
Like, but again, just going to intro why I dislike this. Apple's not making a big deal about their product being good. Their customers, every time a new Apple product comes out, their customers make a big deal about it. Like, Apple's not like, I'm forcing everyone to get in line for the new iPhone.
Yeah, that's kind of like Samsung is saying, like, we're not making a big deal out of this. Like, we're at school, we're all making, but it's like, realistically, nobody actually cares that Samsung's coming out with a new phone.
No, because
is what they're portraying. It's obviously they do have a pretty big fan base. But the fans are not acting the same way. So that's kind of like they're admitting that they're smaller. They're admitting that they're in second place here. The biggest problem that I have with them is that the ads are making fun of Apple's customers and not of Apple.
Yeah.
So, obviously, they're not really trying to sway the type of people that would line up for an iPhone. They're trying to sway the people that are kind of interested in a new iPhone, but they don't, like, they see this, maybe, perhaps, and say, like, oh, I don't want to be that douchebag in line for an iPhone. I'm going to get a Samsung phone because they're even better, and in a lot of cases, they're actually more expensive.
Yeah. The other issue I had with it, I guess, is that the Apple customers that they're making fun of is, like, a pretty small margin. Which, I mean, I guess I don't really know. I've never stood in line for an Apple product because I've never had an issue waiting a couple weeks for one. But I am willing to go on a limb and say that most people who are willing to camp out for the new iPhone know a fair amount about the product other than that the headphone jack is going to be on the bottom. And, like, that's what they referenced in this one. Like, the guy's like, yeah, the headphone jack's going to be on the bottom. And that's really the only thing they said. And it's like most people are a little bit smarter than the ones portrayed in this ad.
So I don't really like the ads, but I think that they are kind of representative of Samsung. And they're well polished, they're well made, and they are communicating exactly what I think Samsung wants to communicate.
Yeah, because, I mean, like you said, they're attacking Apple customers. It's going to be hard for you and I to like them.
But also they ran a print ad that was also bad, but it was in the right direction. It had a picture of an iPhone 5 and Samsung S whatever, something, something, dark side, something.
Something, something, dark side.
And then they had a list on the left under the iPhone of all the iPhone's features and a list under the Samsung S whatever of all the Samsung's features. And that is exactly what they should be doing, right? Just put the phones next to each other, say, this is what theirs does, this is what ours does, and then people can say, like, oh, they're about the same, or, oh, this one's got even more. Except that there's two big problems with that. One is that they start reducing features into this checklist idea of, like, oh, it's got this check, it's got that check, it's got this check, and that's a bad thing. The other problem is that they put in lots of obviously kind of bullshit features under the Samsung phone.
Oh, yeah.
That were, like, branded features, and even non-technical people could see through it because it's, like, name of whatever with a little registered trademark after it. And it's like, well, okay, so you've registered something, and like, Apple does the same thing with the names of their features, but it's, like, pretty obvious that you're just in kind of grasping at straws here.
Yeah.
Which makes it seem really disingenuous. And for, like, a full-page New York Times ad, that kind of sucks. But the idea of it, the direction of that ad, I think is a lot stronger. And probably, I mean, it's nicer because it's not attacking me, which I like. Mm-hmm.
But although, again, the idea, I don't even know if it's necessarily a bad idea to attack people like you or me who swear by Apple and are, you know, those the guys that stand in line. You know, the guys that, no matter what you tell them, they're probably not going to buy a Samsung phone.
Yeah.
So you poke fun at them and you prevent anyone else from becoming people like.
Yeah, that maybe that's effective.
I mean, to an extent, I'm sure is effective.
You said you've never stood in line for an Apple product.
No, I've never stood in line for any product, to be honest.
For any product?
Any product.
Have you stood in line for... Well, have you gotten to midnight releases of movies? Usually you don't have to stand in line for those as much.
Yes, and I have stood in line to buy tickets for the midnight showing of a movie. Like when Star Wars... I mean, granted, it was episode 2, and we were, terrible. But we were hoping. I mean, you were hopeful every one of those that something had changed with George Lucas.
Yeah, I guess.
Speaking of, I don't really know if this is necessarily appropriate for the podcast, but a friend of mine was in, not a friend of mine, a friend of a friend who I met at an Art Student Union event the other night. Spent some time in rehab with George Lucas's son.
Yeah.
And apparently, George Lucas's son claims that the reason his dad's movies suck is because he started becoming a really awesome dad.
Huh?
And someone with a heart and somebody who understood what it meant to be a dad would probably say, oh, that's sweet. But from a 20-something guy who doesn't have kids, I say, you shouldn't have been a very good dad. You should have made better movies. Your kid's in rehab anyways.
That's really dark.
It's super rude.
Are you saying that he said that she said that they said? Okay, so there's a lot of steps.
It's a lot of he said, she said, they said.
There's a ton of... It's probably all not true.
Yeah, yeah.
So
although the timeline works out.
Yeah, the timeline works out. As far as when he had a kid. I have also heard from mutual friends that this guy that so on. Is it fair to think that Lucas made the films worse because he spent more time with his kids? Is that what the point is?
Yeah, that's the idea. Okay.
That doesn't seem like a good enough reason for them to be bad.
Oh, no. Because I'm sure before he had kids, he had just as many distractions.
Yeah, or... distractions don't... I mean, he still had unlimited resources, so distractions don't really qualify as an excuse for making bad things.
And my thing is, like, if he spent, you know, an extra 10 hours in a day with his kids, it should have just taken him longer to make equally as good movies.
But here's the thing. I have heard him say that Star Wars is primarily a children's movie, which is why those movies are not bad. They're successful because children like them. And it's true, children like them.
Yeah.
So if having a kid and then being a good parent and spending a lot of time with his kid changed his perception of what good entertainment is, that would be a valid reason,
That's true.
So George Lucas has this kid. I've never thought about this before, but George Lucas has this kid. And then he kind of understands, like, oh, kids like flashing lights and long, tedious political speeches that have no bearing on the actual plot. And they like these weird caucuses that have tons of characters that you've never met before, but they all fly around and do these convoluted
Jar Jar things. Binks.
And they love stereotypes. They love just the most obvious, terrible stereotypes. So you don't wait in line. Okay, this is a tangent from a tangent, but you don't wait in line for products, or you haven't waited in line for products.
No, I've waited in line for experiences, but I have not waited in line for products.
What differentiates an experience and a product?
You
said you waited in line for movies, and I was thinking,
I'm thinking
in line to see a movie. You wait in line to buy a book? Like, that's kind of similar, right? But it's obviously more of a product. Have you waited for a book or not?
I have waited for books. I guess I'm trying to think of a way to, you know, say product versus...
Well, it's like you haven't waited for a thing versus
I've never
something.
Waited for a thing. I've waited for food. I've waited for a ride. I've waited for a movie.
That doesn't... Okay, waiting
all the
in
normal
line
things.
Because
all
there
the...
is a line is different from, like, going to the midnight launch of a book or a video game.
I've gone to midnight
movie,
launches of books and movies.
Okay. I very much enjoy waiting in those lines.
Mm-hmm.
Because of all of... I mean, it's maybe fairly simplistic, but they kind of, like... reduce a group of people to a common enemy. The enemy is time. And you all have the same goal of, like, getting that thing. And it's, like, it's sort of this the kind of forced friendship you get when you're in elementary and junior or even high school, where you're, like, around a group of people so much that you just kind of become friends with them. Obviously in a much smaller way because you're in line for a few hours, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But you get that kind of like, we're next to each other and we're kind of in this together, so we'll become friends. You meet interesting people. Obviously, there's some shared passion because you're all in line for something you like.
I guess I would compare that friendship more to like if you have to go to like a conference or like an orientation and the guy's sitting next to you more than like even being in high school.
I think orientations are a bit different because you're kind of like you're going to spend time with them, whereas at a conference, you maybe meet people that you're going to know for 3 days.
Yeah.
And yeah, you keep up on Twitter and maybe other sort of social networks. But for the most part, you're meeting for a very short time. I also really like conferences, so that's a pretty apt, I think,
because most people start to hate you after 4 days.
Like most people most people figure it out in about 4 days. You know, it's about the amount of time it takes.
In 4 days, most of your friends leave you.
Yeah. So yesterday, I was not at a conference, but I went to this hackerspace called Noisebridge. And I don't want to say that it was started by Mitch Altman, but in my mind, it was started by Mitch Altman because he was there and is fairly influential in the hacker scene. And also, I met him at a conference. See my segue there? I met him at Hope Number 6 in 2006. So Noisebridge is this hackerspace, and I was there because some friends were taking a class in surface mount soldering, which is kind of like soldering chips onto a board. And we got there a little early, and we were kind of sitting around on our laptops getting some work done. Mitch Altman was there. He's a pretty internet famous dude. He's the inventor of the TV Be Gone, one of my favorite inventions, and probably the best Christmas gift I've ever given anyone.
Yeah, we've talked about the TV Be Gone.
We talked about this. Yeah, the TV Be Gone.
Does your dad still have that, by the way?
Yeah, he still has it. I think I know where it is in his house. My brother has the super high power version, which is supposed to go for 100 meters, and it's obviously a lot bigger than the normal one. It has 8 LEDs in the top of it instead of one LED, infrared LED, right, that flashes the off code. So the TV Be Gone is just a universal off remote. You hit a button and it sends, like, every single TV's off code turns off every single TV.
This is like a tangent from a tangent from a tangent.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. That's fine. That's okay.
Can we at some point, preferably during, like, a large game, like a playoff or, like, a Super Bowl, go to, like, a really terrible place, like a big sport, like a Buffalo Wild Wings, where there's, like, a billion TVs, and just shut them down.
Since what it does is it runs them in sequential order. So it's, like, Sony, and then it does Samsung, and then it does Toshiba, and then, you know, like, Zenith. It goes all the way down the line and just does, like, one code after another. So it maybe takes, like, 15 seconds or more to do all of them. But if you go to a place like that, usually the TVs are all the same brand. So and you hit it, and then they all go off at once, and it's awesome.
And if you timed it, like, perfectly, like, right as someone was about to run in to, like, score a point, you just shut it off. People would go nuts.
People go nuts. And at places like Buffalo Wild Wings or, like, chain sports bars, they're probably going to have systems set up where the TVs just automatically turn back on after a certain amount of time. Like, they just have to be on. They maybe are even smart enough to just have blockers in front of their IRs. Like, so what happens when you have kind of corporate control, or if you're teching in a room that has a lot of devices, what will happen is a little transmitter will be taped right over the receiver of the device. And so you have a control unit, and on that unit, you can say, like, I want to switch to the VCR, and you hit the VCR button, and it sends a signal to all of the other devices to turn them off, and it does that by having, like, a physical IR transmitter taped on top of the IR receiver of the devices.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like this really hacky way to get things done, but it's probably actually one of the most foolproof methods to do it. And it means you can just kind of buy components at will and throw them in there because the commands will be relatively the same. It's pretty easy to reprogram.
Did you say foolproof? Anyway, did you say foolproof?
It's relatively foolproof.
Foolproof. Really?
What?
Not foolproof?
Not foolproof. It's not foolproof. F-U-L-L. Yeah. Foolproof, not foolproof.
Really?
Foolproof. Yeah.
I mean, I never really used that word, but I've always thought of it as foolproof. Like, it's a foolproof plan. Like,
I understand.
Even a fool could do this plan.
I understand that. But I've always considered it to be alcohol. It's foolproof. Like, this is the strongest it can be.
But that doesn't make sense. Like, this plan is alcohol. Because, like, proof
is the measurement of how much alcohol is in something, right? And it's double the percentage.
But,
Straight alcohol is 200 proof. That would be foolproof. Or, like, foolproof vodka would be, like, as much alcohol as you could possibly have in vodka without killing you.
Yeah, but, okay.
Foolproof.
That doesn't make sense if you're making a plan. Like, let's make this plan as
foolproof?
Alcoholic.
I'm not going to make foolproof. It foolproof.
Yeah, it's foolproof is, like, even a fool could execute this plan.
That's true. I understand that. I'm not saying that yours is wrong. So, yeah, you look it up right now, and I'll keep telling my crazy tangent stories. So if we jump one layer back from the tangents, TV Be Gone, awesome universal off remote. We'll go back another layer of tangent. The ultra high power version is modeled after an iPhone 3G or 3GS, so it looks like a fake smartphone, which is pretty sweet. Kind of silly because it really could be built into any shape and people probably wouldn't question it that much. I'm starting to forget how many tangents we need to go back here, but I'm just going to jump right back to NoiseBridge and keep talking about it.
Okay.
NoiseBridge is this hackerspace, which it maybe is intimidating to people that aren't super familiar with hackers in general. If that's the case, you should check out the podcasts by 2600 Magazine. We'll link to them in the show notes, which you can find at verbmill.net/thewhitehorsecourier. So it's the space where people come together and they've rented kind of, you know, medium office size space in the Mission District of San Francisco, which has relatively manageable rents. And there are tons of different tools. There's like a CNC and a laser printer and 3D printers and soldering irons and like piles and piles of old electronics that are just fair game to take apart and do whatever you want with.
Mm-hmm.
While we were there, we were helping the guys from SparkFun load in some equipment and move some stuff around. SparkFun is a supplier of small electronics, like circuit boards and things.
Yeah.
And so they were putting on this workshop, and while we were helping them in, they didn't really know that this was our first time at NoiseBridge. So they were kind of talking to us about the space, and one of the guys said, I like that that you guys have this much art up around, because normally hackerspaces don't have any art, or normally the places we go don't have any art, and you know, it's like weird that the technical side of things or the technical people have art up. And I was kind of flabbergasted by that, because the overwhelming feeling I got at NoiseBridge was the same feeling I got at the art building at the college that I went to and you currently go to.
Yeah.
Which is to say that like there are shelves of equipment and tons of different tools. And then there's not really any specific rules about who can or can't use things. And it's just kind of generally like, if you know how to use something, it's fair game. And if someone wants to use something and they don't know how, you should teach them how.
Yeah.
And
or you should just simply ask, and someone in the room knows how to use it usually.
And is totally willing to help out. Or like, if someone is working on something and they need an extra hand, you know, you can just stop whatever you're doing and help out for a little bit.
Yeah.
And then also kind of fair game where, like, not that people are tagging it with graffiti, but you can just kind of put up whatever you want. And so if you make something that's cool, you can just put it on the wall and no one's going to ruin it. Or maybe they're going to add some stuff and make it better. And that's kind of the game. And then there are like shelves that have really intricate projects on them and then a little piece of tape under it with the person's name. And it's like, I've spent months working on this and I'm going to trust it on this random shelf. And maybe these are expensive parts, but they're just hanging out here. And that is exactly the same as the art building. Occasionally you get the douchebag that steals paintbrushes or ruin stuff. But
there's been somebody this year, this semester, who's been stealing art off the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been doing it in such a strategic and dick-like manner that I know the people who have been caught on it, or like people who have, they've had their work stolen, like they've had the critique, but the teacher usually like goes back and like looks at the stuff hanging on the wall to grade them, and they do it like before the teacher grades it.
Ooh.
So the teacher's like, oh crap, you know, I don't want to just give you an A, but I don't want to make you. And
it's kind of unfair to grade someone poorly because their art was stolen.
Yeah, and I don't mean to be like kind of a dick about it, but like the stuff that's been stolen, I've been kind of like, really? You stole that?
You stole that?
Like, compared to the other stuff on the walls, that's what you decided to take?
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, so I don't know if it's someone like just trying to like screw someone over, but yeah.
I mean, I remember
stealing from
people. I remember
I remember when you used to steal from people.
Yes, I never stole art from anyone. I remember going through the building and taking pictures of people's art, or sometimes, if I knew them, just taking their art to put it up in a gallery that needed some extra art to fill up the gallery. And you know, you could argue that that's really kind of an abhorrent practice. But at the time, it was like, we have this gallery, and not many people submitted their art, and we want some good art in it. Mm-hmm. And here's my friend who I know, and they've got this art on the wall. And I'm just going to take it and put it up. And if they have a problem, obviously I'll fix it. But I'm not going to ruin it. I know how to hang art. So that was fine. That's obviously not what they're doing.
But yeah, hacker spaces.
So this hacker space is kind of an anarchistic society where like everything kind of goes. But there are some rules. So there was like a stack of shirts. And if you donated more than $20 or something, you could take a shirt. And obviously you could just steal a shirt, like they wouldn't notice. Mm-hmm. and it's very much like the Halloween ball of candy in front of the house that says please take one.
Those never work though, because kids aren't good people.
This place has been open for at least 4 years.
No, that place works because it's adults, but the Halloween candy thing, okay. I'm just warning our listeners, because Halloween's coming, don't be that idiot.
You live in an apartment. Do you have to do anything for Halloween? Do you have to get any candy to give kids?
I don't know. I'm in a new building. I haven't seen very many kids around here. My old building, my first year of college, there were some kids in the building, but I didn't really think of it. And I came home on Halloween probably at like 8 o'clock. Both my roommates were gone. And there was like a knocking at my door. And we had like no solicitors were allowed, but these kids lived in the building.
Yeah.
And I sort of knew them. And they like opened the door like, trick or treat. I felt super bad because we didn't like have any candy. So I like am fumbling through my apartment. I found $4, $1 bills. And then I took the $2 and I like taped them to a package of ramen noodles. And so each kid got a package of ramen noodles and $2. And the look on their face was just so sad.
That's so depressing.
I felt so bad for them. And like the rest of my building, I'm sure gave them very similar.
Yeah, because it's an apartment building. You don't really expect kids to be trick-or-treating.
I would like it if I knew when I could expect it, but...
I mean, you should probably just buy a stack of candy bars, and then one of two things will happen. Either kids will come, and you'll be the awesome guy that gives out whole-size candy bars, or nobody will come, and then you will have awesome full-size candy bars for yourself.
That's what my mom does. She figured out that, like, okay, so you go to the store and you buy, like, a huge bag of, like, fun-size candy bars that they have on the Halloween special.
Mm-hmm.
Or you go to, like, a Sam's Club or a Costco and you buy just, like, a normal size thing, a king size. And she doesn't get enough trick-or-treaters that it makes, like, she loses a ton of money. But she's like, and then I can give them to the kids. And if I have two or three left over, it makes sense to have those to, like, bring with me to work. Or, like, have them, because nobody likes a fun-size Snicker bar.
You're talking about, like, the type of boxes that you buy for concession stands. Yep. Where it's, like, a box of, like, 36 packs of Starburst.
Yeah.
Which is the best road trip purchase you can make.
Oh, yeah. Starburst? Are you saying directly Starburst? Or just
those boxes? Not only Starburst, a box of multiple entire packages of Starburst. Because it's way more exciting to eat them out of that, like, that weird foily plasticky wrapper thing.
Yeah.
and then having multiple packages of them is kind of ridiculous and awesome.
Yeah. Although I would say that if you're buying multiple packages of something, depends on where you're traveling and what sort of air conditioning you have. But chocolate usually doesn't withstand a road trip.
Ah, that's why you buy Starburst.
Yeah, Starburst, Starburst and Skittles are kind of my favorites.
Yeah, but you can't have Starburst and Skittles. That doesn't make any sense.
No, no. Have one or the other.
Okay, depending on where you're going.
Yeah. Traveling and you always, East Coast. And you always, 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 on any road trip, need gummy worms.
Gummy worms?
Oh, I love gummy worms. And if
I mean, if going to the grocery store to get the bulk candy, which is the best and most ridiculous and least healthy deal there is.
Yeah.
You fill that up and you get a healthy quantity of gummy bears or gummy worms in that.
Worms. I said worms, not bears.
I'm sorry. They're basically the same thing. Unless they're sour. You never have a sour gummy bear.
Yeah. I don't like sour gummy worms either.
Really?
No, there's too much.
That's wrong.
I like eating like two or three of them, but you eat like more than three and your teeth just hurt from the sugar.
Well, don't eat more than three. Just eat two.
Well, yeah, you're driving and you're tired and you have a bag of them next to you. Who's going to just eat two?
If you're driving and you're tired, you eat popcorn.
Yeah, I don't have a popcorn popper in my car, Mr.
You get gas station popcorn. It's like $1 for like 17,000 kernels.
17.
You can eat handfuls of it as quickly as possible for over an hour and you still haven't finished the bag.
You need like 7 bottles of pop to make that work, though.
Yeah, yeah, and you probably shouldn't be drinking that much pop because then your kidneys explode as you're driving. let's get back on track here.
Get back to foolproof versus foolproof.
Okay, so you've looked this up now.
I looked this up.
Let's hear it.
And it says the word foolproof means impervious to fools, just as bulletproof vest. Then, in the bottom part, it says the nonsensical foolproof.
Full, F-U-L-L.
Full. The nonsensical foolproof is not nearly as common as foolproof, but it does occasionally appear in some normally well-edited publications and websites, for example.
What is your source on this?
This is the Grammarist website.
Grammarist. I've used them before. I kind of like their stuff.
Yeah, they're pretty thorough.
That's understandable. I've always interpreted it as being like the maximum amount of proof that is allowable.
Yeah.
Not that I know distinct, like, the specific rules, but, like, different types of bourbon or scotch or all of those have different rules for what is allowed and isn't allowed. And, like, once you pass a certain threshold, then it becomes too strong and it's no longer scotch or something like that. That might only be a bottom threshold, though. It might be, like, if it's only 14% alcohol, it's not scotch. So I've always considered it to be, like, the most possible
proof.
Yeah, proofs. And that's the reason for that is because the way we use these terms does not have to be directly applicable to the situation.
No, I will point out that foolproof is one word and foolproof is one word, but hyphenated.
Okay.
So
that's how I would have done foolproof hyphenated as well.
But yeah,
that
would have
is incorrect.
I wanted a quick mention again, before we get into the real nitty gritty commercials. A listener sent in a little website with a lot of celebrities and voices of products that they do a lot of the commercials for.
Really?
Yeah. Shout it to me on Facebook. Okay. We'll put the link in the show notes. Whose voice is that? Identifying some familiar voices in TV commercials.
Cool.
So I'm not going to list them because it doesn't really matter.
Well, don't say that.
Well, I mean, it matters to the ones we talked about, and that's what matters.
Link will be in the show notes for that, and thank you very much.
Hey, we're in San Francisco, Google's backyard, for the Bing It On Challenge. Let's Bing It On. What's your preferred search engine?
Search engine? Probably Google.
Google.
Okay, what if I were to tell you that I bet you an Xbox 360 that you would pick Bing over Google? If we do a side-by-side blind test comparison, and you end up choosing Google, you get an Xbox. But if you choose Bing, that means I'm right, and I get to have your sweatshirt. Why don't you look at a place where you can get a new sweater, since I'm going to be taking yours. Yeah.
All right. Hot fashion sweaters.
All right.
All right. I'm digging the right.
Bing won! So strip it and dip it, because that is now my sweater. Bing won! Bing! It looks like Bing won.
Bing did win.
Oh, it looks like you're going to have to embarrass yourself by running across the street in your underwear. You are a Bing man.
San Francisco! Bing is better than
people chose Bing web search results nearly 2-to-1. Join the 5 million people who visited the challenge at Bing.com.
Bing!
Have you seen the Google Chrome commercials?
Yes.
Okay. Same sort of concept. They go around on the street with a microphone, jam it in someone's face, and say, "What's your favorite browser?" And everyone says, "What in the hell is a browser? Get away from me."
Yeah.
So there was a callback to that. It was like the first question, right? When they're like, "What's your favorite search engine?" And the first guy was like, "Google, right?"
Yeah.
And that's kind of calling back that, like, they did that, and now Chrome is super popular and a pretty solid, pretty all right browser. This ad takes place in San Francisco.
Yep.
It's they call it Google's backyard. Google is in Mountain View, pretty close by. They're not really leveraging the fact that they're in San Francisco at all. So that was all there just for that one line.
I guess.
Go ahead.
I'm going to just say about the place of it, location of being in San Francisco. You said it's sort of a tourist area.
Well, they're specifically in a touristy area of San Francisco.
Of San Francisco. So I just want to say, like, I don't even necessarily know if, like, this whole, like, put a mic in someone's face and have, like, three people do it on a physical computer matters more than, like, marketing it on the internet. Because, like, I think if someone came up to me and said, "Hey, take the Bing It On challenge," I'd just walk away. If somebody said to me, like, a thing popped up on my computer, like, "Decide which is better, Google or Bing," I'd be like, "Okay, I have 2 minutes. I'm at the computer. I can do this."
Mm-hmm.
So
the concept is that they're showing these people this this Pepsi challenge style browser war thing, where they give them a laptop and you input a search term, or the people input a search term, and then they get results on the left and the right, and it's kind of a very standard A/B test. They just click whichever one they like more.
Mm-hmm.
And then it keeps track and I guess in this situation it's technically a single blind, or maybe it's double blind, because the guy there doesn't know which is which either. Mm-hmm. But he probably does know. He can tell, I would bet, if he's doing it a lot. And so single blind test, they pick A and B and A, whatever. And then it says, like, "Oh, you picked Bing 3 out of 5 times," or however many times you picked it. And then the extra fun in this commercial is that people are kind of gambling. They're gambling either the clothes they're wearing. One lady gambled her baby against an Xbox 360. The guy that lost, I mean, they only show people losing, right? Well, no, they showed one guy winning. They showed one guy who was a Google man and then won an Xbox, supposedly. They show the people losing and then doing whatever. So one girl is speaking in a microphone. In one cut of the episode, a guy's running around in his underwear. And it's essentially a new version, and modified from the original, a new version of the Pepsi challenge, where it's like, here are the two things, and we bet that you like ours more, even though you've been programmed to like our competitors more.
Yep.
I think this is interesting because it kind of ties in with that Samsung commercial we talked about, which is why I was willing to talk about it earlier, in that, like, here are two things, and you are programmed to like the iPhone more, but actually you'd probably like the Samsung phone more if you gave it a fair chance. And that may be true.
Although,
it's probably not true in that case, it's true in a lot of cases.
I'm going to put it out there that the difference, the biggest difference between this and the Pepsi challenge, is that the Pepsi challenge put Pepsi in a cup and Coke in a cup. And, I mean, maybe if you're someone who's very particular and says that Coke only tastes good out of a glass cup, blah, 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 you could argue that you're not getting the same Coke that you usually enjoy. But with this ad, they look very different than the actual sites do. And I'm not saying that Bing is ugly, and I'm not saying that Google is beautiful. But I'm saying that, and maybe it's because I've been programmed to use Google makes a lot more sense, and Google is a lot easier for me to use than Bing. So have they shown up in, like, the way that Bing actually looks and the way that Google actually looks, I probably would pick Google.
Did you pick Bing? So we both did this. Did you end up picking Bing over Google?
I ended up picking Google, but it was like 3-2.
All right. Mine was 4-1 in Google's favor.
Yeah.
And it was difficult for me because I was thinking when I was like, what should I search? I have a go-to search when I'm checking a new search engine. And I'm like, I can't do that because I know Google's results on that.
Yep.
And then I was like, what were the last things I searched? And there were some recipes I wanted to try and maybe some products. And I was like, well, I can't search those because I recently saw Google's results for those, so that wouldn't be fair.
Yep.
So I ended up just kind of looking around my room and picking words out that struck me. And then I also did one equation.
Yep.
And
yep.
I obviously too. Google killed Bing on the equation.
Yes.
I mean, they were both right, and they got order of operations correct, which is good, because a lot of calculators don't get order of operations correct. But they, I mean, Google provided a full calculator there and gave more details, and then Bing just, like, wrote the answer, which is not what I want.
No, which, yeah, I guess how I did it was I typed in a word, like a sort of, you know, a word that someone might look up looking for the definition of it.
Mm-hmm. I think I did define colon space something. Maybe yeah. I didn't put the colon in the space because that's a little bit unfair, but...
Oh, yeah. 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 I did that, and then I looked up a famous person.
Mm-hmm.
I looked up Don LaFontaine, who's not really famous, but someone famous enough that you Google.
Famous enough that they have search engine
I did
results.
An equation. I looked up... I asked a current event question.
Oh, that's good. I don't think I did any current events.
Yeah. Both of them were pretty crappy. And then I asked... What was the last one? Oh, I Googled my name.
Ah,
and I figured who would give me the most of my name would make me the most, would excite me, which is a terrible, actually a pretty terrible way to judge a search engine.
Maybe. But maybe like one of them gets weird articles from way back in your childhood of like your soccer team won and they listed all the soccer players.
Yeah.
And like it's from 1996. Like there's a that bunch would be really
of,
cool.
Yeah, there's a bunch of, if you Google my name... old running results
from like when you were running in high school and you were winning a lot, presumably.
I wasn't.
Well, you were winning enough to have your results published.
Yeah. I was getting like 19th place in a game.
Ooh, that's shameful.
After you have like 5 19th places, they let you get the paper.
All right, we'll put you online. You're not going to be in the print paper. But,
no, they put you just in the print. Mom, I got in the newspaper, but only the print section, so nobody saw it.
I think the first time I was in the newspaper under my own power was when Halo 3 came out. My brother and I rented the local movie theater. We rented two of the screens and had a midnight release party, and then we like sold tickets.
Dude, every time you tell me this story, it makes me just visualize how big of a video game nerd you were in high school.
So we rented this theater, and we did everything legally. We got permission from Bungie to play the game in a theater. We actually talked to the guy who's in charge of 343 Industries right now. They're making the new Halo game that's coming out very soon. And he said, as long as you're not charging for play, it's fine. And so we sold tickets to come to the event. And then as part of the event, everyone would have... everyone would have a chance to play multiplayer, or like would be able to play multiplayer kind of in a random assortment, and then everybody would be able to play single player campaign for like 5 minutes or something. But we worked it in a way where they weren't paying specifically to play. Anyway, we did this whole thing. It was just great. We, you know, my brother and I was in high school and he was early at college.
How many people showed up?
We got a couple hundred.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was not a tiny thing. Like, it wasn't gigantic, but it was pretty successful.
Yeah.
I remember I was in either chemistry or physics. I don't remember which class, but it was the same teacher for both. So he came up to me and was talking to me about it. And then he showed me the comments on the website for the newspaper. And the first comment was like, this is obviously free publicity for blah, blah, blah. And like, it was, it was really butthurt that we got in the newspaper for our event. And it was like, the story was about kids making something happen. Like, go a little bit easy.
Yeah.
And we got letters in the mail too. Like, I got a letter from, I think, a construction company that like made houses. Like, the head of this small company sent me a letter that was like, hey, I'm really proud to see that you guys are entrepreneurial spirit and, like, blah, 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 doing all this stuff. I was like, that's really awesome. And then here's this guy complaining that we got in the newspaper.
That's like, really cool.
It's a small town, man. There's not going to be that much news every week.
Yeah. close to that. It wasn't me. It was my brother. When Star Wars Episode 3 maybe came out, him and some of his friends went to go to the get tickets or whatever for the release, and they actually had tents. I don't know if they were really that excited. Maybe they were that excited about the movie. I think
It's fun to wait in line, like you said.
And so while they were there, they started a lightsaber battle like tournament with like everyone in line, and had like everyone like set up brackets and stuff. And most people were like doing it in costume and just being like silly about it. But like my brother was like wearing sweatpants so he could like move better and like getting real serious about it. And he made it to like the championship round. And the front page of the newspaper the next day. And the reason it was so funny is I had a paper route that my dad helped me with, because you'd have to go pick up the papers. You go pick up the papers, we're driving back in the car. And usually, like, my dad would kind of, like, look through the paper as he was driving home. And he, like, grabs the paper and looks at it, and he's, like, looks to the front page, and he's just like, ah, that's what my son was doing last night. And it was this large picture of my brother, who was, like, 18 years old at the time, lightsaber in hand, fighting this incredibly nerdy-looking 30 to 35-year-old man with a lightsaber. And it was just, like, he was so embarrassed by it. And it was kind of bad, because he ended up, like, skipping class and, like, skipping practice.
Ah, yeah.
And there's a lot of, like, recoil on that photo.
That same thing happened for our Halo...
Oh, yeah.
...Midnight Release Party. So we had a story before it that was like, this is coming up, you should go get tickets. And then we had a story after it about the event. Mm-hmm. And I remember I went to school the next day, so I was up until... We only rented the theater for 2 or 3 hours. So I was at the theater until about 3 or maybe 4. And then I went home, and I hadn't gotten a chance to play the game yet because I was too busy running this event. So I just put the game in and started playing until about the time I had to go to school the next day. Because video games are released on a Tuesday. So it was like Tuesday morning and I was going to school. And I remember talking to one of the English teachers, and she was like, oh yeah, it's cool that you ran that event. I'm kind of surprised to see you here today. Also, here's this newspaper article about it. And the picture was of this kid that had attended the event that I didn't know. And she's like, he's not here at school today, and I wouldn't have, like, docked him points on this test that he's missing, except I know that he's missing the test because he was out late playing video games. And I was like, I mean, you know, I didn't really feel too responsible because I was at school, so whatever.
Yeah. I mean, if you got done at, like, 3 o'clock, that's no excuse.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's still plenty of sleep to go to school. I feel like there's one other thing that I wanted to mention about this to maybe make it relevant. The sword battle thing. This is to keep our tangents somewhat relevant.
Oh, yeah.
We were talking about road trips earlier.
You're making our one tangent relevant by connecting it to another tangent earlier.
I don't know the first time I saw these swords, but I think it was on a bus to a speech meet. We had these like big foam swords that you get at the dollar store.
Yep.
They're stiff enough that you can swing them around and kind of hit people quickly, but not really strong enough to hurt anyone. And they don't break that quickly because they're made out of foam instead of like cheap plastic.
Yep.
Those are the second best after Starburst, after a huge box of Starburst, the second best thing you can bring on a road trip. And what you do is you get like 12 or 14 of them. You get a ton, just way more than you need, because you're going to break some, and you're going to lose some, and you're going to give some away.
12 to 14.
You stop at a rest stop. Yeah, it's $12, all right? Everyone going on a road trip can spend $12 on swords. You stop at a rest stop.
Oh, yeah? Oh, you're going to stop at a rest stop.
I know Tom hates rest stops, but everyone at rest stops is on a road trip or driving a long way, so it works best at a rest stop. Or if you're in a cool town, maybe just wherever the town is. And you open up your trunk, and you just lay the swords in the back of your trunk, and then everyone in the car has a sword fight, and people will walk by and laugh at you, and then you toss them a sword, and they join the sword fight. And it's awesome, and if you have kids, they spend all of their energy sword fighting, and if you're, like, an adult, you've been tired from being in the car, so it gets your blood flowing.
Yeah.
You
stretches your legs
crazy
out,
people, you're having a sword fight. You can use it to challenge each other, settle debates. You let out all of your road trip aggression. It's fantastic. It is the best decision that anyone has ever made, second to getting a box of Starburst for a road trip.
I was going to say, best decision someone's ever made.
for a road trip after getting a box of Starburst. And I
Emancipation Proclamation or getting foam swords for a road trip?
Well, it's debatable.
It's a close one.
Let's jump back to this Bing It On commercial. Yeah. This commercial is pretty awesome. It convinced me to try Bing, not to switch to Bing, because Bing is not better than Google for what I search. But I don't really like Google that much, and I'm glad there are competitors.
Yeah.
And
the one thing that did turn me off is when I went to Bing, because what I did is I did the Bing It On challenge.
Yep.
Then I went to the actual Google site, and then I went to the actual Bing site and searched. And originally, Google like was far, far better. But then, like you mentioned, it was probably the cookies in my computer.
Yeah, so we talked about this before the show.
Yes. So what I did is I did it on a neutral computer when I was on campus. And so I did this, and Bing, when you go to the Bing website, if you type bing.com, there's like a small banner at the top of it that says, "Have you tried the Bing Challenge?" I don't necessarily think that's that smart of an idea.
Yeah.
And here's why. If somebody's already using Bing, there's a chance they might become a Google user. There's no incentive for bringing someone to Bing when they're already at Bing. And so I just think it's, I guess it's a pretty silly move on their part.
Their reason for doing that is probably to get Bing users to share it. And maybe that's successful, right? So if you're a Bing user, if such a person exists, you go to Bing, you see this banner ad that says, "Have you tried the Bing Challenge?" Which is stupid because you're a Bing user. But maybe you say, "Oh, I haven't tried that," and you try it. Hopefully you end up picking Bing, or maybe you don't, whatever. Either way, you're seeing the Bing word more, the Bing trademark more, which is good. Hopefully they're thinking you will end up sharing it with people, and that will add to their virality of their marketing. I can't totally fault them for it, but I agree. It sucks to see advertising for the thing you're using while you're using it.
Yeah, and it is very small. It is very minimal. But at the same time, I just think there's like, it's kind of annoying, and B, there's the slight risk that you might convert one of your users into a Google user.
All right, I think that brings us to the end of this episode of the White Horse Courier.
Oh, wow.
If you're interested in listening to more great podcasts, you should check out Dwell On, which is kind of another podcast on the same Verb Mill network. It's about houses and homes and architecture and what makes a house into a home. And you can find that in iTunes by searching Dwell On. You should also, while you're in iTunes, search for the White Horse Courier, make sure you're subscribed, and leave us a good review, because that actually does help us kind of reach a bigger audience. And that's what we're all about, you know, is just whoring ourselves out. Yeah.
Well,
if you're interested in seeing any of the content that we've talked about this week, we link to everything in our show notes, which is at verbmill.net. That's verbmill.net. And we'll talk to you next week. I'm Will, which is at Will Imholtz on Twitter.
And I'm Tom Wixo, which is at Tom Wixo.